My name is Charles Murray, and I'm a social scientist and writer at the Manhattan Institute for Policy Research. About 4 years ago, I wrote a book called Losing Ground that suggested that all had not been well in the 20 years since the Great Society. It raised considerable controversy. In the last 4 years since that came out, I have been pursuing those thoughts and have recently been bothered on the one hand and had hopes on the other of changes that are occurring in the way we do business in this country. I am bothered in particular by what I see as a variety of quite specific demographic and political trends that I think over the next 5 to 10 years may very well result in a major change in democracy as we know it. More specifically, and we can talk about this later, I am very worried that we are going to take one large segment of the population known as the urban underclass and start to treat them in a custodial way as wards of the state who are not people with thoughts and minds and aspirations and responsibilities of their own. By the same token, however, I have been playing with ways in which we might think about social policy and public policy in general that will move us ahead. And in this regard, I have written a book that will be coming out in October of 1988 called In Pursuit. In Pursuit, of course, refers to the pursuit of happiness, the old Jeffersonian notion. I am aware that happiness is an honorable word that's fallen on hard times. It is the topic of a dozen books on the airport book rack. It's happiness is warm puppy. But the concept of happiness originally, as used by the founders, who took their cue from Locke, from Aristotle, from a long tradition. Happiness, as used in those days, referred to the object of government, the end of government. The purpose of a society was to enable its citizens to pursue happiness. And so I've been exploring the ways in which, by considering the question, how do human beings pursue happiness, we can get new leverage on how to pass laws and regulations and run government departments in ways that allow people to lead better lives.
When losing ground hit the bookstores, there was, if I recall, an immediate reaction from the liberal, what I would call the liberal left, and they began to use your name as a synonym for reactionary. Did the reaction to the book surprise you?
It surprised me that there was so much reaction to the book. I remember in one of the very final drafts having a paragraph in the last chapter that said something to the effect that if people read this book and think this is an excuse for cutting government budgets, then they've missed my whole point. That in fact, if you want to cut the budget and get rid of the budget deficit, what you ought to do is go after the huge sums of money that are being passed around by constituencies in the middle class, because that's where the money is, not in the fight against poverty. I cut out the paragraph, ironically, because I said to myself, this will make this serious scholarly book too political. As it turned out, of course, it became highly political. And the first surprise was that it got so much attention. I was pleased by the initial wave of reactions to the book, which were, generally speaking, I guess respectful is the right word for it, by people who disagreed with me. I'm thinking specifically of Nick Lemon in the New Republic, but who granted both my good faith and also granted the existence of a problem. Shortly thereafter came the second wave of reactions, which were ad hominem, which were absurd in terms of a lot of the criticisms they made of the book, and which were cries of outrage and anguish.
Yes, the claim that you were a social Darwinist, that seems to be one of those pejorative things that are thrown out at anyone who doesn't accept the quote liberal perspective.
It would be interesting to know how many people who call other people social Darwinists have even heard of Spencer and even know what social Darwinism is. It's one of those phrases that you can use without having to explain yourself. I guess I would also say that a great deal of the controversy about losing ground, if I may be cynical, was among people who had not read the book, The book became a series of headlines. It was sufficient if you knew that Losing Ground says nothing works, that the Great Society has been a failure, and that we ought to completely get rid of the social welfare system. And once you had those three headlines, you didn't need to actually read what I said.
Yes, didn't need to bother with the core. In the preface to the book, you write, quote, Losing Ground grew out of 16 years of watching people run social programs, unquote. What were you doing during those 16 years? Where were you watching?
I started out my career in Peace Corps. I was a Peace Corps volunteer as soon as I left college in 1965.
And you became a social Darwinist. That seems inconsistent.
I know. Well, something awful must have happened to me along the way. In fact, I shouldn't be facetious. The experience I had in Thailand, where I was a volunteer and where I remained for 4 years thereafter, working in rural modernization, had a profound effect on the way I look at the world. In a couple of ways. In fact, if you look at In Pursuit, the prologue to In Pursuit is entirely about my experiences in Thailand and trying to point out the ways in which such experiences dominate your thinking. But I had a couple of things I took away from that experience. One was that I had the very salutary experience of realizing how unimportant government programs are in everyday life. I was sent up to some Thai villages to investigate how they were responding to these efforts to win their hearts and minds. And it took me a couple of weeks, but it finally got through my skull that the reason I couldn't get them to talk about these things very much was they weren't very interested, and that what went on in their daily lives was not directed by that. The second thing that I took away from that, particularly after I came back to the United States, is how bankrupt our measures of progress are when we're trying to assess, let's say, progress against poverty. I very seriously doubt if you could find a place in deepest Appalachia or in the depths of the South Bronx where people are as poor as they are in the typical Thai village. And yet, in the typical Thai village, you have a lot of people who are leading satisfying lives. Now, let me interject here. I am not trying to make a modern-day Rousseau article argument about noble savages. I'm saying something else, that in Thailand, which has a very free society, you have a lot of the raw materials for living a satisfying life in terms of raising a family, making your living, being a good neighbor. And it's these kinds of things which have been stripped from people, I think, in the United States, and that cause the poverty that we ought to be worrying about.
You're saying that happiness is in the eye of the beholder, then?
It's not quite as relative as that. Actually, I'm saying that there are a couple of constituent elements of happiness that, no matter how much we disagree on the specifics, we can probably agree on in generalities. I'm talking about things as basic as saying it is impossible to pursue happiness if you are devoid of self-respect. If you think about that for a minute and say, how can a person be happy if he has no self-respect? I think the answer is obvious. He cannot be. Similarly, you cannot be, it's difficult to pursue happiness if your life is full of danger. if when you walk out the front door, you have to worry about whether someone is going to knife you in the back. Basic statements like that. And furthermore, you cannot pursue happiness, or more reasonably, it's very difficult to pursue happiness, if you do not have deep connections with the people around you, your community. I am not using community, let me underscore, in the sense that Mario Cuomo uses it regarding a national community. I'm talking about the people with whom you live. Now, that being the case, what you see in a Thai village, I think, and for that matter, what you see in American small towns, what you see in a few fortunate American urban neighborhoods, but not all of them by any means, are people going about their lives in ways which enable them to have self-respect because they're pull their own weight, because they're good parents, because they're good neighbors, in which they are safe, for indeed they have managed to structure the life of their community in a way where there is lawfulness in it, structure it in a way in which they have the kinds of belongingness and intimacy that they require with their fellow human beings, because the community is performing essential functions that relies on them behaving in these ways to exist. So happiness, as I am using the term here, is basic stuff, saying that you get long-term satisfaction with life as a whole, which I think is a good working definition of happiness, by meeting some very basic kinds of human functions.
Clearly you're saying, though, that happiness is not tied to enormous amounts of material wealth.
That's right. In fact, if you think about it, there is clearly a threshold below which you can't pursue happiness. You cannot pursue happiness if you're starving. However, if you then ask, can you pursue happiness even though you have relatively little money, the answer is, of course, yes. I mean, people have been doing it for thousands of years. The question is not, as we have said in the United States in recent decades, how do we provide people with enough material resources and then let them go off and find their satisfactions in life where they will. My argument is very strongly bound up in this premise. You can't separate those functions. The way that people go about providing themselves with material resources for living a life are also things that are tied up in the ways in which they achieve enjoyment, self-respect, and all the rest.
It seems to me that on that point, the issue of self-respect, I find very little disagreement with that, even in the, quote, the socialist advocates, that giving people money or giving them the physical things they need, I think it seems to me everyone somewhat acknowledges that isn't going to lead to happiness. Is that true or not?
There is agreement about that, which I think is very provocative, because I think that social democrats can be hoist with their own petard in this regard. Let me give you a specific example. There's a man named Michael Walzer. I believe he teaches at Princeton now, a very well-regarded social philosopher, also a good social democrat or socialist, I'm not sure which. And he has, as far as I'm concerned, precisely the right understanding of the difference between self-respect and self-esteem. He says that self-esteem is that thing which you feel if enough other people say that you deserve it. If enough people say to me that they think Losing Ground is a great book, I will feel self-esteem no matter what I think of Losing Ground.
Yes.
But self-respect is different because it's internalized, and there is this sense of measuring up to what you perceive as the standards of being a member in good standing of the human community. And you can't fake the verdict on that because they are internalized standards. I think he's absolutely right in that. Michael Walzer, on the same page in which he gives this beautiful definition, says that he thinks the welfare state is the best way to provide this kind of self-respect because it doesn't demean people. And at that point, I tear my hair and I say, Michael, you've done so well up to that point. Don't you understand that what you've just said is people must earn their lives, in a sense. Not as simple as just earning a living, but they have to be doing something to earn their lives. And it's precisely the welfare state which undercuts that essential process.
Yeah, I could pursue that further. I'm going to drop it because it's an area we could spend the next hour on, and there are some other things that I'd like to chat about. Let me come back to some fundamentals. What was the major field of study that you pursued in college?
When I was an undergraduate, history, and then when I went on to graduate school after these years in Thailand, I got a doctorate in political science from MIT. Mind you, from MIT, political science is not what you might think. It is, I took every course in numbers known to man, I think, while I was there, and not a single course in political theory. That's the way. It was a very good education in its own way, but a very strange kind of political science.
Well, the political science label would suggest you were interested in public policy questions, and I assume that since you did the PhD after being in Thailand, the answer to that is fairly obvious, that by that time you were interested in public policy questions. Did you have that interest before you went to Thailand? When you were studying history, was that a part of your...
I'm one of these people who, I'm now in my mid-40s and for years was asking myself what I was going to do when I grew up, and I'm not sure I've answered that question yet. What I was interested in, even in college, was exploring all kinds of questions. and not in the context of a university position. I can remember clearly back in college thinking the ideal place to work would be the Rand Corporation, which did all these studies on different fields, and I could go from one to another and just have this huge smorgasbord of interesting questions that would occupy me the rest of my life. And that is, in fact, what I did throughout the 70s after I got back from Thailand, in effect. I was an evaluator of social programs. The federal government, along with all the money that it spends on the programs themselves, also demands that these be evaluated, and it pays fairly large amounts of money to private, independent, nonprofit, nonpartisan companies to do these things, and that's what I did. That, of course, is what ultimately led to losing ground, because as I looked at a variety of programs, everything from programs for chronic delinquents to unwed mothers to you name it, there were a few common themes. And the most dominant theme was the programs didn't do what they were supposed to do.
Was that the primary thesis of losing ground?
It was the trigger that got me to pursue this further. By 1981, I had been writing these evaluation reports for many years, in which in the last chapter I would say, well, unfortunately the program failed to show any impact on indices A, B, C, D, and F. The reasons why it did not appear to be in these diagnostic failures, whereby there were problems in implementation and this and that and the other thing, and here's how you can fix these problems. And I realized, first, the problems never got fixed. And the second thing I finally began to realize by the early 1980s was that they weren't going to get fixed. Milton Friedman has a wonderful phrase which he found called the invisible foot, which is the analog to the invisible hand. And the invisible foot is what tends to make almost any social intervention fail. And the analogy is very close. There are all these unseen forces that, no matter how carefully you design it, are likely to frustrate your plans.
In writing Losing Ground, you looked at an awful lot of data. What was the biggest surprise you found there? What statistic really stunned you, even though you...
The first one that really stunned me was just the poverty numbers. You see, you must understand, I did not say to myself, I am going to write this book that tears apart the Great Society. I was quite certain that we had major problems with our social programs before I started to write the book. True. But I walked into it fully believing that despite its successes, at least the Great Society had reduced poverty in this country. And I remember very clearly the first time I graphed these straightforward numbers on the percentage of population beneath the poverty line. And as I first looked at it, it looked as I expected. Here was a steep downward trend in the 1960s, and then it stopped going down in the 1970s. And it took a little while, I think it took a day or two, before I suddenly stopped and said, wait a minute. Most of this reduction in the 1960s occurred prior to 1968, and it occurred during the early 60s as well. And in 1968, hardly any money was being spent in the Great Society yet. The money didn't really get spent until much later, and it's in that period when the progress against poverty slows. And then when I went back and reconstructed the poverty line back to the 1950s, and actually 1947, what you found was that there had been dramatic reductions in poverty from the end of World War II until the late 1960s, when the War Against Poverty program started to kick in.
Hmm. In your prologue, there's one sentence that I thought it seemed to sum up the problem. Let me read it. Quote, "We tried to provide more for the poor and produced more poor instead," unquote. Did that occur because we changed the definition of poor, or were there more poor?
If you take the broader meaning of more poor, we produced more of them. And if you take the number of people who are below the poverty line in terms of the official definition, we evened out in the 1970s, and then the number of people below the poverty line started to go up in the late 1970s. If, however, one takes, I think, a much more meaningful definition of this kind of poverty, which says, how many people were able to earn a living on their own that kept them above the poverty line? I'm talking about working-age people now. The answer is that the number of people who were able to do that decreased over the 1970s. So the number of people who were dependent on government help to earn a decent standard of living increased. More poor instead.
Well, you mentioned Milton Friedman. He would say that we made it more profitable to be poor, and therefore we got more poor. You agree with that? Is that what the figures show us?
Yes. I will quickly say that, and I'm reflecting here are the accusations that I've been answering for 4 years. I do not think people carry a calculator around in their pocket and pull it out and decide what the economic payoffs are before the young woman decides to get pregnant or the young man decides not to look for a job. That's not what happens. What happened instead during the 1960s was that we changed the rules of the game in all sorts of interlocking ways. We did not change them for middle-class people very much. We changed them for poor people, and most especially for poor young people, and most emphatically of all for poor young black people. Some examples. Welfare, yes. The old bête noire welfare indeed was a problem. The payments did get larger during the 1970s, but that was the least of it in terms of the money increases. Consider this. If you were a young woman in 1970, and let's say you're already pregnant, there is nothing in what I'm saying that says you decide to get pregnant to get on welfare. Let's say you're already pregnant and you have a boyfriend. What do you do in 1970 as opposed to 1960? Now, back in 1960, first place, the money was very, very little that you could get on welfare. So even if your boyfriend had a lousy job, if you get him to marry you, you probably were going to have a better standard of living than if you were on welfare. But consider this as well. In 1960, if you did go on welfare, you could not live with your boyfriend, or with any other man, for that matter, because the social workers, if they caught you, would cut you off of welfare. You could not go out and supplement your income with another job, because then you'd be taken off welfare. Similarly, your boyfriend had no access to anything except a job, and so even though he might not want to go out and get a menial job, as indeed most youngsters of 19 and 20 don't want to do, he didn't really have any choice. And I would argue that what happens then is the best consequence, which is after he's gotten into that job, he finds, if he does a decent day's work, that he gets a more secure niche. He makes a little more money. He doesn't get rich, but he gets a secure place in the workforce. Meanwhile, in getting a secure place in the workforce, he begins to realize that maybe there are a lot of satisfactions to be had in that as well. And it's not just that he's doing a meaningful job, he's doing something more important than that by working. Okay, that's 1960. By 1970, that whole set of incentives has flipped over. The money the woman gets and the medical benefits and the food stamps and the public housing and the rest of it make it a much more attractive package. She can live with a man because the Supreme Court has said so in a decision in the late 1960s. She can get a job and supplement her income and still get welfare. The United States Congress has said that in legislation that it passed, and so forth and so on. And meanwhile, the young man who still finds it distasteful to go out and work at a menial job now finds that he has a whole variety of options he can pursue. For one thing, he can live off the woman. And I think we have vastly underestimated George Gilder and I think his insights into the very complex ways in which that has destroyed communities. If he wants to do crime or drugs or something else, he can get away with that a lot more easily than he could in 1960 because all of the penalties and sanctions associated with that have loosened. And finally, when you look at their educational background, it's much less likely in 1970 that the young man can read as well as he could in 1960, much less likely the young woman in 1970 has the skills she would have had in 1960 because the educational system has also changed its rules of the game, meaning that it's much easier to sit in class and not learn anything. It's much easier to fail to go to school and not suffer any penalties. So I'm saying that in the 1960s, it was not one single act of legislation, it was not one single incentive that changed. The rules of the game for living your life as a young poor person shifted all over.
Was it this shift that resulted in what you state as the redistribution of wealth from the working poor, if you would, to the less industrious and less responsible poor?
Some redistribution of wealth, but I think that the more important thing that happened was a redistribution of status. You know, middle class and affluent people are fully aware of the importance of status. I mean, look at the BMWs and the rest of it. Well, you know, that's just as important for poor people. And the kinds of things I'm talking about are ones that maybe this generation, my generation and younger, don't know directly, but our parents and grandparents did. Such things as saying, with fierce pride, we may have been poor, but we never took a penny from anybody. I mean, that is not just something that somebody says to brag. That is a fundamental statement of how they see themselves. Mm-hmm. That is extremely important.
Self-respect, it's...
That's right. And the pride there should be authentic pride. That's not making it up. You deserve pride if you're able to say that. If you are able to say any number of other things which separate what historically in the United States were the good folks from the trash.
Yes. The children may only have one set of clothes, but that set of clothes is always sparkling clean.
And the house may be small and shabby, but the house is also always sparkling clean. And it's also those kids who better bring home a good report card, because if they don't, they're in big trouble. You know, and the thing is that these behaviors were rewarded. And they were rewarded in the most important of ways, which is the esteem of other citizens. And I don't just mean other low-income citizens. If you go back and read the novels and sort of get in touch with the fables of America up until 30 or 40 or 50 years ago, rich people were essentially a fairly exotic but effete and not very morally praiseworthy bunch. In the America of the turn of the century and later, it wasn't so much that rich people were awful as they were suspect. Whereas the backbone of the country was the person who didn't have much money but was paying his own way. If you go to, and I'm thinking especially the inner city now, if you go to poor neighborhoods, especially in the inner city, one of the most tragic things that you encounter are the stories of the 16-year-old who goes home to his father, who has been working all his life as a janitor, and says that his father is a chump. He is a sucker. And that he, the son, is certainly not going to be a chump the way his father was. What we have done to let the son think that, I think, is one of the greatest sins that we committed in social policy in the last 20 years.
Yes, I will just second that statement personally. You make a reference in one of the chapters in your new book, In Pursuit, which I've had a chance to read because it was excerpted in a magazine, that seems to me relates to this, where you make a statement regarding the sense in which we no longer distinguish between lower class and lower income neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm. There
Tell
is
us a, about that.
There is a wonderful book published in the early 1890s by W.E.B. Du Bois, the black sociologist. It's actually one of the first books of systematic sociology by anybody of any race. But what he does in Philadelphia in the 1890s is include maps showing the black community there and the social classes and how they split out. Now, mind you, 1890s Philadelphia, blacks were under incredible oppression. I mean, there's no comparison to even the 20th century, let alone the 1980s. But you had very well-defined neighborhoods in which you had the black working class who lived together and who controlled their neighborhoods, enforced their norms, and went about their lives. Contrast that With the situation that you find now, if you are low income and trying to live in Philadelphia or any other large city, whereby a few things are going to get in the way of you doing that. One of the things is that an 18-year-old single mother can rent the apartment next door to you with a rent supplement from the city and move in next to you and provide an influence to your children that you aren't really crazy about. The city can open up across the street from you a halfway house for felons. And there's not much you can do about that. You have homeless on the front walk urinating against your front stoop, and there's not much you can do about that, or about the drug dealers, or about this, that, and the other thing. And what has gone on, I would argue, is not to be found, solutions to it is not to be found in increasing the number of police or anything else. The solutions to it are to be found in letting people make up neighborhoods with other people of like values. And quit, if you are the government, imposing on these neighborhoods the kinds of deformations that I've just described.
In other words, let all the low-class people live in a low-class neighborhood.
And this kind of separation will occur naturally. Believe me, I am not talking about the government program to identify low-class from working-class. This kind of distinction occurs if you let it occur. The only reason it doesn't occur is because you have created some kind of artificial situation.
And of course, you're not talking about race here or
no.
Particular types of people. It's that behavior.
The racial issue is one of the confusion of the racial issue with the class issue is one of the things that most inhibits, I think, straight thinking about this. If you read a book put out in the 1930s or written about the America in the 1930s by a sociologist who was describing classes of people, his class five sounds exactly like what we contemporarily think of the black urban underclass. He was talking about whites in a small town in Indiana because the behaviors were exactly the same as those we identify with the black urban underclass. Similarly, you have white underclass in this country. I would much rather talk in those terms because I think that lets us get at the core of the problem.
Is this what you were referencing when you began our discussion today by expressing your great concern about the future and a crisis? Is it this kind of thing that's leading to that?
Let me elaborate a little bit on that. Several things are happening. And they are all underwritten by what I have found over the last 3 or 4 years to be a very dangerous enthusiasm, and I must say I'm talking about liberals here, on the left, an enthusiasm on the left for thinking about these problems in racial terms. I did an article once where I was pointing out that illegitimacy rates among poor whites were quite high, and that this was more of a socioeconomic problem than a racial problem. And the reaction I got from some very well-placed academic intellectual liberals was, everybody knows that the real problem is black here. So that's what underlies it. I'm afraid that what's going to happen in the next few years are two or three things. One is that the new programs that are going to be tried under President Dukakis or President Bush are not going to work. I mean, there will be such new programs. I mean, the conventional wisdom is out there. We've got to do something about the homeless. We've got to help the children in poverty and the rest of it. We're going to try. And I will simply say as a flat prediction, it's not going to work any better this time than it did last time. So in a few years, you are going to have people out there saying to themselves, gee, we gave them one more chance and they still weren't able to take advantage of it. Second thing that's going to happen is that we are going to continue to have very tight labor markets from everything we know, except during a recession. Given moderate economic growth, the labor markets are going to be so tight that nobody can say there are no jobs out there. There are jobs out there right now in most American cities, and there are going to continue to be. They pay pretty good money, oftentimes including benefits. They're only a subway stop or two away from the inner city. And you continue to have a large core of young black males, especially, who are out of the labor force. That is going to become more and more obvious, and it's going to grate more and more. third piece of the puzzle is AIDS, which is a time bomb of enormous proportions, because if you look at the prevalence of AIDS in the black and white population, not the raw numbers, but the rates per 100,000, black acquisition of AIDS is about 3 times the rate of white acquisition. And the reason for that is because it is more strongly rooted in drug transmission, and whereas white homosexuals have proven very effective in changing their behavior and organizing the rest of it, the drug addicts just aren't susceptible to that. So you're also looking at 5 or 10 years at a very high prevalence of AIDS in the black community at the same time that it has been leveling off or even dropping in the white community. You put all these things together and then add one other element to the mix, which is that 20 years ago it was decided that it's legitimate for the government to treat people differently as groups. It's okay to treat blacks differently from whites because it's the right thing to do and it's going to help compensate for the legacy of racism and the rest of it. That legitimacy of treating people as groups continues, but will be continuing, I am suggesting, in an atmosphere of increasing animosity and fear and anger toward the inner city underclass. And to me, that just, I look at that and I say, I don't know how it's going to play out exactly, but it's dangerous. I think something very similar in its feeling, if not in its specifics, to the way we treated American Indians is in the cards. I mean, even now, the inner city is something that most white people, you know, they put up their windows in their car and they drive through and they don't have to pay much attention to it. I think we'll just isolate it further.
So we're going to have a new wave of discrimination.
For their own good, of course.
Yes, of course.
Yeah.
And it's going to be an intensive, deep-rooted discrimination. And it's going to result from programs that originally sprang from our desire to eliminate all these.
Yes, I think that it's going to be very much a sense of saying, well, we'll give them enough food that we don't have to worry about, and we'll give them enough housing and the rest of that, and we'll give them medical care, and so, you know, we won't let them starve in the streets, but we will give up on a very fundamental aspect of America's ethos, which is everybody has it in them to be a competent, self-determining human being. And once you've given up on that, once you've said, here is a large chunk of the population that we don't think has that in them, I think you have compromised American democracy in a way which it can't withstand. I'm not talking about something that's going to happen in the next 15 years, but maybe in the next 50 or 100.
So life, liberty, and the pursuit of property or happiness becomes life, limited liberty, and no happiness.
Becomes life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness for some. In a funny kind of way. You know, I guess that one of the allegations made about American society in the 60s by its radical critics was that that's the problem, that it was a life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness for some, and what we had to do was empower all these groups that had been kept out. And that was such a profound irony, because what we have demonstrated, I think, in the last 20 years, to oversimplify a bit, is that the old way of doing business provided more permeability, both upward and downward, than we have now. I mean, you know, one of the things we didn't do before the 1960s is make it real easy for people to keep their money either. We didn't make it real easy for them to pass on to the next generation in a protected kind of way all of their advantages. Did you have a leg up if you had money? Of course you did. Nothing wrong with that. But you also had lots and lots of room for people to come up through the from the bottom, and lots of rooms for people to fritter it away. That historically was a very strange set of affairs, because historically societies have always tended to solidify themselves in ways where the haves protect what they have and lock out the have-nots from easily getting into it. And if you compare today with 1950 and ask about the permeability of American society, I would say there's a strong argument to be made that things still work just fine for everybody who is at a certain social level and above, and below that, we're keeping people in their place fairly effectively.
I'd like to turn to a question that fascinates me. It's related to your interests, but I certainly wouldn't suggest it's central. But I'm curious about your feelings on it. You mentioned earlier John Locke, etc. Did a little bit of research, and John Locke's statement about the inalienability of life, liberty, and property. If you look at the history, and I'm sure you're aware of this, in the Boston Town Meeting in 1772, they used that language. In 1774, the Continental Congress used it. The state of Virginia, in its well-known Declaration of Rights that George Mason crafted, used life, liberty, and the pursuit of property. Along comes Jefferson, and pow, it's pursuit of happiness. Why did Jefferson pick happiness? Why did he change this trend? And do you have any idea at all about his motivation? And
at one time, I had done the historical research on that, and it's been long enough ago now that I wouldn't want to try to repeat it in any detail. I guess what I took away from that exploration was that the shift wasn't as important as it might sound today, because as in so many other things that went on in that period, there was a common assumption about what they meant by what they were saying. So that happiness was not in any significant sense diluting the importance of property. In a way, I think Jefferson thought that he was expanding upon what was implied in property. Other things like that happened all the time. For example, in the Constitution itself, the demand for the Bill of Rights was strongly opposed by a variety of people who said, wait a minute, we don't need to have the Bill of Rights because we've so clearly said here mm-hmm. that if the government is not explicitly permitted to do something, they can't do it. I mean, everybody knows that. And so you had all sorts of things that they didn't feel they had to spell out because their consensus was sufficient. And I think that the problem about property fits into that. Nobody seriously questioned the importance of secure property rights as the underpinning of everything else.
And in today's context, property, as opposed to wealth, if I can make that distinction, mm-hmm. is important in one's assessment of one's happiness.
Well, when you started to say that, I was thinking about the status of property with regard to the current system. I don't know if you're familiar with a book called Takings by Richard Epstein, but it's brilliant. It's just a brilliant disquisition, which takes off from the provision, I guess, of the Fifth Amendment, which says that private property shall not be taken for public use except with just compensation. And over the course of several hundred pages, Epstein just brilliantly tells all the ways in which the entire state in the 20th century is unconstitutional in effect, but also all the ways in which we have simply destroyed the meaning of property in terms of the state. In terms of its continuing importance for individuals in the pursuit of their happiness, I think property continues to be an absolutely central characteristic. Almost everything that we do, and I'm thinking now of myself as a father, trying to provide for his children and raise his children and the rest of it, sooner or later goes back to our ability to manipulate and use the resources we have accumulated. And it's not necessary that they be huge resources, it is necessary that we have the right to take advantage of those resources as we see fit.
So that for the individual who has minimal or what we might on first appearance assess as being no property, he has the right to property, which
yes.
in a certain sense is almost a property in itself.
Yes, and if he does acquire property, with it will go a variety of other things. And the example I gave earlier of the person trying to live in a poor urban neighborhood and all the ways in which his property rights are being infringed by a government which, in the course of infringing those property rights, is also destroying the fabric of his neighborhood. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Your point is very well taken.
What social conditions are there that lead to happiness that are totally dependent on government, or essentially dependent on government.
Well, in the book, in Pursuit, I talk in terms of enabling conditions, and I talk in terms of relatively few. I say that material resources is one. By enabling conditions, those things which enable a person to pursue happiness, because I make as a very strong point that nobody gives anybody happiness. That has to be a quintessentially private pursuit. But material resources are one, safety is another, self-esteem is another, self-respect, and finally enjoyment. Of those, the one thing that the government, I think, plays a central role in serving is safety. I mean, it seems to me that historically no one, no matter how limited a government they envision, except the anarchists, denies the role of the state in preventing citizens from harming and coercing each other. In other words, police force and national defense and the rest of that. So that's the one that the government fills directly. With everything else, and I think this was the wisdom of the founders, with everything else involved in the pursuit of happiness, the government doesn't have a whole lot to do with it. The government may think it does, the government may try to, but in fact, the way these other enabling conditions are provided depend ultimately on the behaviors of individual human beings. And governments just tend to mess it up.
Additional thoughts on how we came to think of the reverse? It seems like we think of government always as the way we're going to solve problems here.
You know, I would like to have a good answer to that question. There are certain points in our history, I think, where you can see pivotal intellectual watersheds. We saw one of those, I think, in the mid-1960s, when it was decided by intellectuals who formerly had not thought this, that the system is to blame when things go wrong. If a child is not studying in school, it's not the child's fault, it's the fault of the educational system. If he goes out and knocks over a liquor store, it's not his fault, it's the fault of his environment, so forth and so on. Now that comes rather close to what you were asking about. Once you decide that the system is to blame, then clearly the only way you can fix things is by using the government. I suspect, however, that the original shift, the assumption that government is a force for good, probably got started, as if you want to pick a time, in the advent of the New Deal, where indeed for the first time government was seen as a benevolent positive force, whereas it had not been before.
The quality of life in the United States, as you've noted in a different way, certainly started improving rapidly after World War II, and for a fairly large percentage of our citizens, it has seemed to me, it has continued to improve throughout the past four decades. But I get the feeling we're not a happier nation today.
Yes. Not only are we not happier among poor people,
right?
I think there's a strong argument made we aren't happier among the wealthy ones. I remember when I was first talking to somebody in New York about writing a book in the pursuit of happiness. He said, yeah, I know all these CEOs who go home in the train to Westchester every night and they're miserable. And I think that's right. And I don't want to try to give you the five reasons why in 30 seconds, but certainly the way in which, oddly enough, we made money more important rather than less in the last 20 years plays a part. It's a funny kind of thing, but if, let me take the poverty line as an example. If one defines whether a person is leading a decent existence in terms of a reified poverty line measured in numbers of dollars, in some very important way, we have said, if you're below that, you must be unhappy, and if you're above that, you have a better chance for happiness. And that has been true in all sorts of things. Comparable worth. The whole notion behind comparable worth is that if you are a nurse and a female, and over there is a male doing some other job, and you can calibrate the worth of those two jobs, and the nurse can find out that she is making $50 less a month than the male, she has a gripe. The psychologists have done some very, very important work on this kind of issue, where it's called the extrinsic and intrinsic rewards problem, whereby they have proved through all sorts of experiments that extrinsic rewards, money, if you want to think of it that way, tends to undermine intrinsic ones. And we have pretty much set up the government as this instead of Uncle Sam in the old sense, he's a fellow now with a green eye shade, and he's toting up numbers, trying to figure out how much money each person has, and that scorecard is the one we all keep looking at to see how we're doing. And to the extent that that's true, and I'm being perhaps a little colorful putting it that way, but to the extent that that's true, it's easy to see why we are less happy people. Because is there anyone who really has any long-term satisfactions from knowing he has $10,000 more this year than he had last year? I mean, I'll be glad to take $10,000 more next year than I have this year. I'm not trying to say I'm indifferent to that. I'm saying as I look back on it 10 years from now, am I going to say, boy, did that change my life? Of course I won't.
Right. Well, in your references to crime, it seems to me that's an example of what you're talking about. You indicate that crime statistics aren't the measure of my sense of safety.
Another example of numbers. How many people who are listening to this tape can tell me what the homicide victimization rate is in their community? And if we determine it is X, and you are afraid of crime at this time, will you be less afraid of crime if I say that we are going to make X into only two-thirds of X? And I suspect that the answer of any person that I know is, that's not how I think about fear of crime. The way that you think about fear of crime, it seems to me, falls into two other broad categories. One is the sense that you live in a community in which the good guys are in control. And I use the word lawful to describe this. By that, I do not necessarily mean a low crime rate. I mean a community in which you can be confident that if somebody does something bad, that first everybody in the community will look down on this, disapprove of it, want it to stop, that the police will go out and search for this person, that if the person is caught, somebody's going to prosecute him, and if they prosecute him and he's found guilty, something bad is going to happen to him. And if those conditions are met, you can put up with a fair amount of crime in terms of the numbers and still feel like you live in a civilized community and pursue happiness. The second thing has to do with what I call public civility. Because, if one is to be precise about it, my chances, if I were to walk six blocks east of where I'm sitting right now, my chances of getting mugged are fairly small. But six blocks east of here, my chances of having insults shouted at me, of seeing somebody sprawled out on the sidewalk drunk, of being accosted by a hooker, they're pretty high. This is unpleasant. And it's not just unpleasant for a white middle-class guy. They are also unpleasant for a black secretary who's trying to make her way home from work at night. They're unpleasant to a parent who's trying to raise children. They aren't the kinds of things that are crime, and they are the kinds of things, however, which make your life unsafe in all sorts of secondary ways. Jim Wilson, the well-known professor, formerly of Harvard, who wrote Thinking About Crime, I think says this very well. He calls it the broken window syndrome. When you have that kind of thing happen, when you can let somebody sprawl out in the street drunk, it's a signal that there's a broken window in your neighborhood. And what has been observed by sociologists and police officers alike is that if you have one broken window that's not repaired, all the rest of the windows get broken very rapidly. And that's what happens with behavior in the neighborhood as well. So I say, let's have lawful community, and don't worry about the crime rates. Just worry about whether the process validates the common perceptions of how law ought to work. And let's also have a certain degree of public civility, enforcing the norms that the neighborhood finds appropriate for public civility.
Well, concluding on a note relative to government, which is, of course, what you're concerned about and what you've been dealing with, is government's role in all of these matters. If I think about pursuit of happiness in the context of politicians, I come quickly to the cliche. Well, they promise everything, and it seems to me that at election time, the only winner, the only one that is getting any happiness out of the outcome, are the politicians and the cronies.
Yeah.
How do we do something about this? What? Yet at the same time, we're the citizens making the decisions at the poll. Has it reached the point where we really have no effective choice, no matter which way we vote?
As long as we continue to make these kinds of decisions on a vote-by-vote basis, we are going to have one continuing theme, which is a constant expansion of the kinds of things we have seen in the last few decades, because, and there are a variety of people who have expounded on the reasons why. What you have to have is a constitution. What you have to have is strict limits on what government can do. And I have to say, one of the most troubling phenomena of the last couple of decades is the degree to which those limits have been transgressed and will be very difficult to reconstruct.